Arthur Yornix has written and directed for opera, theater, dance, film, and radio, and is the author of over 35 acclaimed and award-winning books, including Hey Ow, a children's book, which earned the Caldecott Medal in 1987. His latest book is Making Sense. It is a graphic novel written by Yornix and illustrated by Brandon Lamb and Shelley Paroline. Mickey isn't quite like his brothers and sisters. They're all stronger, they're faster, and they have a much better sense of smell. That's because his brothers and sisters are dogs. They are, in fact, bloodhounds. Mickey's mom and dad are crazy about canines. Their dogs are the loves of their lives and their livelihood, so naturally they're raising their son as if he was a dog. And Mickey wants nothing more than to make his mom and dad proud. Through his 40 years of picture book making, he has teamed up with many famed illustrators, including Maurice Sendak, William Steig, Mort Drucker, and David Small. Arthur Yornix has an event at the Bat and Kill Bookstore in Cambridge, New York, tomorrow night, Thursday night, July 20th at 7 o'clock. Again, the new graphic novel is Making Sense, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Arthur Yornix to the program. Hello, sir.
Hello. Thank you for having me, Jim.
Very nice to have you on the show. I've been a great admirer of your work for a long time, and it's very fun to have you here. Let me just ask my from the brain question first, just
sure.
To get it out of there, kind of cleanse, if you will, which is for you who have worked on so many books and had them illustrated, what is different in calling it a graphic novel?
Well, that's a good question, Joe. This is the first time that in one sense I get to really indulge in the sense of the text. It's a much longer text than a normal picture book. And for me, I have a whole other life in the theater, and particularly writing and directing plays. So in a sense, that the manuscript for this graphic novel, and indeed perhaps most graphic novels, are more like scripts than they are like prose script manuscripts. So for me, this was sort of a terrific hybrid of both the enabling me to work with artists, which I love to do, and at the same time, creating, in a sense, almost a film script, if you will, which is what became the text for this book.
So you started, if I'm right, the career goal was originally classical musician.
That's right, when I was a little kid, yeah.
And then what happened?
You have an hour or two?
Yeah, well my couch is very cheap.
Okay, it's a deal, Joe. I was very interested in music as a kid, and my parents, particularly my mother, decided, well, we'll give him piano lessons as most kids in the 50s, you know. But it turned out that the local piano teacher was a graduate professor in the graduate division of Juilliard. And he really didn't like to teach kids, but he needed some extra cash, so we took on kids. But the way he taught was as if you were, you know, 30 years old. He didn't really understand the notion of a six-year-old.
Right.
It was fatefully a good thing, because I learned real classical music as opposed to sort of Mary Had a Little Lamb and things like that. So I didn't really know any better, and after a tumultuous period, because he was a very strict teacher, I ended up being very fond of him and was being, in a sense, trained to be a classical musician. But then teenage years came upon me, and I had a lot of interest in the arts. I wanted to be a short story writer. I wanted to write plays. I wanted to be involved in the theater. So all of this coalesced to the point where, when I was 16, or between 16 and 17, my beloved piano teacher decided to move to Pennsylvania, and I was living in New York. And that was a big traumatic experience, and that coupled with the idea of exploring other mediums and areas in the arts, I shifted from music to writing.
Your career fascinates me because it is so much made of collaboration.
Yeah, that's quite right. Thank you.
I mean, even in, now that would be more obvious, obviously, in opera and in theater.
Right.
But in books, I mean, if you wanted it to be, it could just be you.
That's
it could just
right.
be you in that room, which it, you know, you probably usually is, but it's still that act of collaboration. So I take from that then that you enjoy the collaboration.
I do. There's something about working with other people on a very specific project and having their input, their ideas. It's sort of the best to me of both worlds. I get to do my solitary thing, and then I come together with either an artist or a director or actors or whoever I'm working with. And that is such a joyous moment because it really is, I hate to repeat the word collaboration, but that word is something very important to me. And so I've been able to carve out a very weird, strange career of in the various eclectic things that I do all involve other people.
And you learn a give and take, I assume, in that.
I say that one more time.
You learn a give and take.
Yes, yes, yes. I mean, that's, in a way, I'm even doing that with myself when I'm writing, because one of the things that I love to do is rewrite. Mm. I'm one of those people who have not, when I put a word down on the paper, it's not cement in, it's not set in stone. So even when I'm working on a text, for example, I have a long time, I've worked with many editors, but I have one long-term editor I've known for over 40 years, Michael DiCapua, and he and I, in a sense, collaborate on the book because he'll indicate where something might be off. He won't ever really suggest specific words or and that kind of collaboration I even enjoy. And so I love to rewrite. I love to revise. That's actually, I like that actually more than the initial writing.
Right. So let's use this book as an example.
Okay.
So do you come up with the idea and then you find the illustrators, or do they come up with an idea and say, we would like someone to write this story? How does that work?
It always starts with the text. So the manuscript was totally complete before any artist came on board. And, one of the things about my career is that it's been difficult to find the right artist. It's not an easy thing because my stories are, well, I think they're compelling. Some people might call them weird. And so to find the right temperament to take on such a... I mean, a boy who is raised with bloodhounds is not your average story. So it took a while in this particular instance to find the right people. And Shelley and Braden turned out to be just the right folks to take it on.
The thing I love about the story is that it's all, and maybe it just tells you a little bit about my upbringing,
okay.
but this is to me perfectly plausible.
Mm-hmm.
that you have these parents who are very loving, very caring, very nurturing. They love their dogs, and they expect some things from their son that they would from their pooches.
That's right. I mean, I first of all, I mean, part of the one of the many threads of all of this is that I grew up in a household where my father was an animal nut. I mean, he actually enjoyed the company of animals more than he did people. There are many anecdotes of him going to a foot doctor, for example, and coming back with a Bouvier because the foot doctor said, if you don't take this dog, my wife will divorce me. And so suddenly in the basement of our little tiny house was what I thought when I was a little kid. My father had bought me a pony because the dog was so... And he in his inimitable way, turned to
saddle
me...
Saddle up.
Yeah, he said, shh, don't tell your mother. As if this giant animal could be hidden in some way. Anyway, there was a lot of animal love as I was growing up. And so, the notion of being raised with dogs, so to speak. And I almost felt like that was true of me. I grew up with a very large standard poodle in the house. And she was, in some way, one could say, I mean, it's a little odd to say, but she was sort of my sister.
Mm. So in telling a story like this, as I said, there's a plausibility and something that I think not only adults but certainly children would relate to.
I hope so. I think so. I think so.
Am I allowed, and I would have asked you this question, you came in here rather urgently because we had a guest that did not show up, so we brought you in early, which the question I was going to ask you off the air, which I'll ask you on the air, is am I allowed to say where you're staying?
Where I'm staying? You mean?
What brings you up here?
Oh, sure. Yeah, why not? Yeah,
of course. So you're staying in Maurice Sendak's old house.
Well, truth be told, technically, yes. About 20-some-odd years ago, Maurice and I actually bought that place together.
Yeah.
And I have, after a long journey, sort of returned to that wonderful place in Cambridge, New York. And the house that actually I designed for Maurice, a sweet little house on the edge of the property, that is indeed where I'm staying.
So what does that, and again, this gets back to collaboration, but what it means to come back to a place like that and how that helps in a writing process?
Well, I mean, that particular place and the area of Cambridge and it's actually just north of Cambridge. Oddly, it was an odd story about coming across it. And it wasn't planned for Maurice, and it wasn't planned for me to be involved in it. But as fate would have it, we jumped in together with it. And it for a kid whose family is from Brooklyn, New York.
Yeah.
Oddly, this place feels like home to me. It's probably the furthest you can get from Brooklyn, New York, except maybe when Brooklyn. In the 19th century, but there's something about the landscape and the land, there was a corn crib of all things, a building on the property of which I turned into my studio many, many years ago, which I'm returning to. So there's something very sweet and wonderful about being back.
You collaborated with Maurice Sendak on the two operas of his books, one being Brundabar and the other being In the Night Kitchen, correct?
Brundabar was a project of the Night Kitchen Theater, of which Maurice and I founded. And indeed, I worked on sort of the back end of all of that, producing the opera. Maurice collaborated with Tony Kushner on the actual creative part of it. But it was sort of the last project, if you will, of the Night Kitchen Theater. And I met Maurice back in late 69-70 when he was in the middle of working on the book In the Night Kitchen. There might be an opera of In the Night Kitchen that's in the sort of in that development stage. We don't know yet.
So, but it's always a possibility.
There's always a possibility, yeah.
Yeah. What is it about his work that lends itself to opera, do you think? I mean,
Maurice's work?
Yeah, I know I've talked to him about this,
yeah.
And it was always fascinating to me. And I'm curious from your perspective.
Well, Maurice was innately a theater person, though he came to it in so-called mid-career, when he actually was very much involved in the theater designing and writing. But I think all of his works... I mean, even if you go back to the early Ruth Krauss books, those incredibly wonderful little pictures of children crawling and dancing and moving and going all over the place in accompanying Ruth Krauss's text, they're so theatrical in nature. So I think he had a sense of theater very, very early on, and his texts are... so rhythmic and so rich and complex, and they are, in some cases, very adaptable to the theater.
All right, so one more question about Maurice Sendak, then I promise we'll get back to you.
That's okay.
So
he was an old friend of mine.
I know. So you find they're passed away in 2012,
right.
And then you find... and this just made news, you find another a book, a book that is what state of completion?
Totally complete.
Totally complete. And so you were quoted as saying, is you have no doubt, no hesitation to believe that he would want this published.
Yes, right.
So what do we know about the project, and how do we, what, you've seen it, obviously. What do you think of it?
Well, because I co-wrote it, I think it's terrific. I think it's absolutely fabulous. It's a masterpiece.
So how did it not get, it's called Presto and Zesto in Limbo Land,
that's
right?
That's right, that's right.
Okay, so how did it get to be, how did we get to that in working to the point where it never gets published?
Okay, well.
So for you, it was never forgotten then?
No, it was never forgotten, except it was put sort of in the back of my brain, such as it is. What happened was, Maurice had done these glorious pictures, this suite of pictures, for a London Symphony Orchestra concert around 1990. And they accompanied a musical suite written by a Czechoslovakian composer, Janáček, who had written a suite to various nonsense rhymes. And these nonsense rhymes did not relate to each other. They were all each different, and Maurice did pictures to each rhyme, and hence the pictures were all each different, although, of course, in the same style. And the pictures were projected for the concert as the music was played. Well, it was done maybe one night or two nights. I don't exactly remember how many performances, but it was a very short thing, and then the pictures were put in a drawer. Years later, they were brought out for one other little concert, and again, put in a drawer. And I was obsessed with these pictures because they're so glorious and so beautiful and so Maurice and so hilarious and brave and you know, just wonderful pictures that I, at this point in time, we were neighbors as well as friends.
Mm-hmm.
And so one day, you know, I'd speak to him almost every day. And one day I was over and we said, you know, those pictures, Maurice, they really could make a book. And he said, well, I don't know. You know, so we spread them out on his drawing table. And one afternoon, we just had a bunch of laughs making up stories. And it was a, kind of a little bit about our friendship. We named the two characters after ourselves. And what, lo and behold, unplanned, is that suddenly a real narrative started. Started as a lark and then became a real thing. I said, wait a second, this is actually working.
I'm sorry, you name the characters after yourself, so are you Presto or Zesto?
I'm Presto.
Okay.
He's Zesto.
Okay, all right. Go ahead.
And I'll tell you quickly why that is in a second. But so what happened was Maurice was very involved in other projects. I was very involved in other projects, particularly theater things. I was, at that point in time, kind of lessening my work in books and much more involved in the theater. And so we put the book aside. We declared it finished. We worked on it for several months. It was totally a finished book. And we thought, well, okay, we'll get back to it and take a look at it and publish it. Maurice was then very involved in Brundabar, which was one of the operas you mentioned. I was involved in, of all things, being on the radio theater, which I'm still very heavily involved in. And so this book kind of just hung out, waiting for its time. It waited and waited, and then very sadly, bittersweetly, Maurice passed away. By this point in time, I was deeply involved in the theater and not thinking too much about books until I got this call from Lynn Caponera, who's an old friend and also the head of the Maurice Sendak Foundation, and Michael DiCaprio, my forever editor, saying, we found this book. And then, of course, it all came flooding back to me, and they said, would I be interested in you know, refining it a little bit and then publishing? I said, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
How old now is the... How many years ago would you have worked on this with him?
About between 15 and 18 years, something
okay.
like that.
So still, late in his work, but very much.
Yeah, we worked on it in the late 90s, something like that. So yeah. Whatever that is, 17 years, 18 years. Yeah.
But that's, I get it. Yeah. So when you probably about a decade and a half before he passed.
Yeah, I mean, the last time the pictures were used were 20 years ago, in 1997. So. A year, I don't know, give or take. They were floating around. So in that time period, that's when we were working.
And in comparison to his other works, how would you not rank it exactly, but characterize it?
Well,
how it fits.
I think I know where you're going.
Well, good. I don't. Go ahead.
Well, you know, actually, Lynn and I were talking about this because we were looking at the originals just yesterday, as a matter of fact, in the whole beginning of process of getting this ready to publish. And and this goes back to your earlier question, they are of an ilk of a very theatrical nature. Meaning that they are reminiscent of Maurice's wonderful, glorious work for designs like he designed Cunning Little Vixen was actually by the same composer Janáček.
Right.
So the palette and the style of it, if one were to, I mean, it's, I'm being a little bit generalizing, but. It's in that vein, and so I think people, and that has not been seen very much in Maurice's picture book work. So I think this will be a revelation. I think people, and I've known Maurice's work practically all my life, and I've known him practically all my life, that people will be, leaping for joy to see these glorious pictures come out. As well as the whole book, but I think it's not for me to judge where it is in Maurice's canon, but I can honestly say that it's a beautiful, funny, hilarious, brave, wacky cuckoo book.
What went into is there a conversation that said? I mean, you talk about going forth, and he was doing the pictures, and I understand that. But in general, and I guess this goes back to my overall question about collaboration of where you, because here is a man obviously who would write his own write his own text as well as collaborate with others. Mm-hmm. So that's a decision that he has, but it's the rapport that you have that says, okay, we'll do it in this way.
Well, he spent many, 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 many years illustrating other people's books before he decided he was ready to write his own. So he, if there was any artist that I've known over the years, and I've known a bunch, the idea of a collaborator is perhaps Maurice's middle name. He knew how to do it. He was great at it. He respected working with other people. He always said the text, ironically, in this instance, he always felt that the text, comes first. This was totally backwards, but he was very used to working with other people, and even on books. And in point of fact, he and I did a couple of other books together collaboratively. So. Not in this particular way, but so it wasn't new or something odd for him to be doing this, and as I said, it was a project that began much more as an afternoon between two friends, fooling around, with telling each other stories, and ended up being a story about two friends, which is quite. Wonderful, and for me, and the bittersweet part of Maurice not being around, it's a wonderful epilogue in a sense, to our over 40 years of knowing each other.
All right, you promised me that you were going to tell me how Presto and Zesto came to be, but let me take a break.
Okay.
When we come back, you can tell me that story, and then
sure.
we'll talk more about Making Sense, which is the new book. Arthur Yorings is our guest. He has an event at the Battenkill Bookstore in Cambridge, July 20th. That's tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. The new graphic novel is Making Sense, and that is S-C-E-N-T-S, we should say. And we'll be back with Arthur right after this. Arthur Yorings is our guest on the roundtable this morning. He is a wonderful author who is the author of the new book, Making Sense, which is a graphic novel with art by Braden Lamb and Shelley Paroline. And he will be at Battenkill Books in Cambridge, New York, tomorrow night at 7 o'clock, talking about and signing the new book. And he joins us this morning. Before we went to a break, we were talking about the newfound book of Maurice Sendak and the work that he did with Arthur called Presto and Zesto in Limbo Land. And this will be published by HarperCollins next fall. And you had promised to tell us of how, as you said, this is a book about two old friends. So how did you become Presto and he became Zesto?
Well, whenever I knew Maurice when he lived in New York City. And then a couple of years after I met him, he moved to Connecticut. And whenever I would visit him in Connecticut, I would take the train. Back in those days, it was a diesel train. It was a long time ago. Anyway, so I knew where he lived vis-a-vis the train station. I didn't know where he lived. I mean, I knew he lived somewhere up in Connecticut. And so as fate would have it, at some point in time, years later, I moved temporarily out of New York City, and I said to Maurice, to a town in New York that bordered Connecticut, and I said, Maurice, I think, I think we're in the vicinity of you. He said, yeah, it'll probably take you about a half an hour to get here. So one day after I got settled in moving, I got in the car, and I was there in 4 minutes. It turns out we lived not quite around the block, but almost.
Pretty close.
Pretty close. So when I arrived in the driveway that day, his first words out of his mouth is presto, as if I had come out of thin air. And I didn't want to let him get away with just me having a nickname. So I named him Zesto, which seemed appropriate to his... I don't know why. It just seemed like he was, one could say, full of zest, whatever zest is. And
I want to hone in on Limbo Land but that's
right.
All right.
So we decided when we were fooling around with the narrative for this book, we decided that the two main characters would be named after us.
Will the art go on display?
Will it go on display? Well, I guess after the book is published, most of Maurice's art, if not all of it, plans are, as we speak, to create a space where people, by appointment, can come and see Maurice's work. There's also plans afoot for an archiving of Maurice's work. So it'll all be available to see at some point in time.
Mm. Because it is beautiful.
It is
beautiful,
absolutely stunning. Yeah.
Stunning work.
Yeah.
Your work, as I mentioned, the new book is Making Sense. And talk about Braden Lamb and Shelley Paroline, who from the back of the book, and this is, I'm not saying anything about you, sir, but
mm-hmm.
I am saying they appear to be very young people.
Yes. Well, you know, I used to be the youngest around. Now I'm the oldest around.
Where did you find them?
Well, the publisher found them, and which is, frankly, an unusual experience for me because normally, against what is the common tradition, the artists that I've worked with over the years have been people that I've either suggested or met or knew or etc. In this case, I had not met them before, but the publisher did send me, I believe, some sketches and some work that they had done. And they seem to oddly, they are young people who seem to understand the time period of which I don't think they were even around in, which is the 1950s, right. Which is where the book takes place. So they somehow were able to capture that kind of feeling in terms of the simplicity of their art and the palette that they used. And so
it's a Sid Hoff kind of look, too.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's well put, Joe. Exactly right. And it that kind of thing fits. You know, you said that it's very plausible, this very odd, crazy story. And that is part of the piece of the puzzle that helps it seem plausible, which is that, you know, it's sort of everything that's odd about it is kind of taken for granted,
mm-hmm.
And including the way they illustrated this book. So I'm very happy with what they did, and it really is a collaboration in a sense.
Everything that is odd about it becomes plausible. That's fine in children's literature. I hope that is not the case in our politics.
Oh, I need another glass of water.
I can't tell you what a delight it has been to talk to you.
It's my pleasure, Joe. It really
great
is.
Pleasure.
We'll have to do this again.
I like that idea, and congratulations on the new book. You'll come back and talk about the new book when it comes out.
I absolutely will.
Arthur Yorings has an event at Bat and Kill Books in Cambridge, New York, tomorrow night, July 20th at 7 p.m. Again, the new graphic novel, Making Sense, batandkillbooks.com for more information. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Joe, very much.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.